payment to Stormy Daniels. And in weather today in Washington, it is 53 degrees under partly cloudy skies. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
All right, good afternoon. I'm Parisa Neruzzi, and this is Taking Action on WPFW 89.3 FM. We come to you every Tuesday at 1 o'clock, bringing the information and inspiration that you need to take action in our city, to fight displacement, save our schools and communities, stand up for justice, build our power, and hold government officials accountable. Taking Action is produced by the grassroots organization Empower DC, and we welcome your feedback and your show ideas. You can call us at Empower DC at 202-234-9119. And welcome everybody into the spring season, one of my favorite times of year, of course, for DC. And I feel like it's actually the beginning of the year because, you know, we really should have our calendar set to begin with spring, as so many other people around the globe do. So I want to say Nowruz Mubarak to all the folks celebrating Nowruz, the new year that Iranians celebrate, as well as many other peoples across the planet, which started on the first day of spring last week. So I'm happy to have two segments today. We're going to be speaking with Tommy Wells, and I'll introduce him in just a second about some current issues. And then later in the show, we'll have a quick catch up with Vanessa Bertelli, who is the director of an organization called Electrify DC, and they are sponsoring the Healthy Homes Fair coming up here soon. So stay on to hear about that. But I'm very excited and grateful that my first guest, Tommy Wells, has decided to join us today. You may know him as the former Ward 6 councilman, or maybe you know him as the former director of DC's Department of Energy and Environment. He certainly has a long and interesting history in working in many sectors here in D.C. and has a new role that we're going to be discussing here in just a minute. So first of all, thank you, Tommy Wells, for taking time to join us here on Taking Action.
Thank you, Parisa. And let me also acknowledge you. I've known you for a long time, and the work that you've done on advocacy around, especially around equity, fairness, for all of our DC residents, I really have appreciated that. And both of my roles, that, you know, that spans 16 years from my side of being elected and such. But thank you for your advocacy and, you know, really providing a voice and helping share the voices of people that really need our help.
Well, I appreciate that very much. And I would love for you to share a bit more about yourself with our listeners, because, you know, getting prepared for today, I was able to go and look at your LinkedIn and learn, you know, you actually have some background that I didn't realize, your extensive background in child welfare, for instance. So please take a couple minutes and share how, you know, a little bit more about your previous roles and how you came to get so involved in DC politics.
Well, thank you. You're exactly right. A lot of people don't know that I started off here as a child protection social worker. And that was during the 80s when our city went broke, when we had HIV and people didn't know how it was transmitted. It was a scary time for a lot of people. And it was also during our crack epidemic. And we were known as the murder capital, but in particular, what was terrible about it is what happened in the late 80s, early 90s to young people, that the murder rate among people under 20 was the highest in the nation. And then we had, when I started at the child welfare agency for the city, we had 1,500 children in foster care. By mid-90s, we had 3,300 children in foster care. We had children that were being left at hospitals. It was a very difficult time. And part of that history, as people don't know, is that I brought a class action lawsuit as a worker in our government against my own employer, and brought a class action lawsuit, brought in the ACLU, the Children's Rights Project, and sued the city. And that lawsuit was only fully settled just a few years ago, that or last year, is last of 35 years, when the city lost on that for failure to protect children. So with that, and then I think what really propelled me into advocacy also in government was we didn't have a family court, so that you did not have judges that had experience in working with children and families and all the nuances related to that. And they weren't the, you know, your attorneys that worked in family law were not the ones who were selected to work in our superior court. They're, you know, they're appointed by the president. And so we now, you have to have experience in working with children and families to serve in our family court. And you have to commit. You're going to be on that bench for at least 5 years so that you develop that expertise and can bring about the reforms. So you're right. I came from an advocacy background on for children and families, served on the school board, and then went on to the city, onto the city council. And at the city council, I did get a lot more involved in many other issues about what are cities going to look like in the future, how to be multimodal instead of just dependent on cars, how to create a safe city for pedestrians, and really a more equitable city altogether. And then went into the environment, and that was, you know, so folks know, I'm a social worker with a law degree. How did I end up being director of the environment? I think it was, you know, I've always had a canoe for the river and those things, but I passed that bill where people thought those single-use plastic trash or bags you get at the store were free, and now you got to pay a nickel, and that is to reduce the amount of trash coming into our waterways. And so I think that's when, you know, I ran for mayor and Muriel Bowser won, and she asked me to run the Department of Energy and Environment. And I think it was really coming out of the 5 cent bag fee when people say, oh yeah, I think he should run the environment. And I did bring a lot of the experience that I had in the community with politics and with the river and such to that job. And I can't say enough about working at the Department of Energy and Environment. The people there that are so committed, you've worked with them. Mm-hmm. They are really folks that love their jobs, that are called to service. And I think we're up to about 500 employees there. It's one of the largest departments in the country because we're both city-state. So you're the state environmental office and the city. And so we do have some of the best educated, smartest, most devoted folks in the country working on energy and environment in Washington. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for that. I appreciate the diversity of your experiences working within the local government, because, you know, like you said, you were elected to the school board. I believe you were an ANC commissioner as well.
I was.
Yeah, council, DOE.
Three terms as ANC commissioner. You're right.
Yes. And like you said, a social worker, an attorney, et cetera. So what a diverse set of experiences that you've had to shape your views on, you know, what's going on here as a city, and how do we improve conditions for people in the community. So interesting to see your current role. Do you want to speak a little bit to this latest role that you've taken on as chair of the No Ward 6 Recall? What led you to serve in this role? Yeah.
You know, I planned on, and I am getting very involved in things that are important to me around good government, and, you know, river advocacy. But what I didn't plan on is the recall effort that against Charles Allen. And, you know, just to say, there's been more recalls initiated across America over the past 2 years in history. It's a phenomenon that's happening. Certainly when we've had a spasm of violence in our city, which is upsetting and awful for everyone involved. Everyone becomes a victim in these crimes. And so the recall movement has hit Charles Allen. And as you know, Charles was really at the forefront after George Floyd and Black Lives Matter of trying to really take a look at the laws that we do have. We have about the highest lockup rate in the nation, and our nation has one of the highest lockup rates in the world. And are we safer because of how many people for how long we lock them up? Can we be smarter to make this city safer? And Charles got, you know, was a leader in a lot of those reforms, but people viewed that incorrectly as, oh, you're going soft on crime because you're not putting people away long enough, or things, you know, things that they worked on. And also in redirecting funds to try to intervene and do violence interruption. So this went on across the country, but DC was no different. And there's been a backlash. And we know that we failed our children during the pandemic. You know, they did very little. If you were from a low income family and you have, you know, siblings and parents are stretched out and stressed, you didn't have schools. And schools are a major role of helping raise children by providing them lunch and breakfast and structure. We have young people that had no structure for almost 2.5 years, and we're paying a big price for that. And so people are angry at people committing crimes, and that's highly understandable. And they want retribution for the crimes or revenge, however you want to view it. And so anything that looks like it's soft on crime becomes political. I mean, we certainly see the Republicans that are, you know, the Trump Republicans in Congress are that really want to undermine confidence in city government because cities vote blue. And voting blue does not, I mean, our city voted 96% against Donald Trump, 96%. And so, and you have to wonder if the 4% was a margin of error. I mean, I don't know what happened. But the point being is that the Congress is controlled by Trump supporters, and they held a hearing saying, look, D.C. is soft on crime, and wanted to use D.C. as an example. So if you blend that, we have people upset that there was some reforms that were passed and that Charles was, you know, leading the Oversight Committee of Public Safety and part of trying to be responsive of what we saw coming out of Black Lives Matter and the aftermath of George Floyd, that there's been black backlash. But bigger than that is that it also has opened the door for national Republicans to say, let's discredit cities. And Charles Allen is part of that movement of saying, let's do recall efforts.
Mm. I'm glad you brought that national perspective, because I actually did not realize that this was a trend happening across the country. You know, I've seen a couple of recalls in the past. I remember there was an attempted recall of Anthony Williams and I think Jack Evans. And, you know, I've never, my understanding is there's actually never been a successful recall of a member or mayor. I'm not sure about an ANC.
Maybe ANC, but that's obviously very different in terms of her signatures and such. So there's never been a successful recall against a council member. So, but yes, I'm chairing that effort and asking people, don't sign. It's, you know, don't sign the recall, because it's going to cost the city if they have to do a special election. And let me assure you, after all this process, it is almost guaranteed Charles Allen will be the council member. But of making it through this process, that's about $2.5 million that we're about to see, one of the most severe budgets the city's looked at since, you know, since the time we became bankrupt. This is going to be a terrible budget to deal with. And then also, if they are successful in getting a recall so that Charles will have to run again, we'll be without a council member in Ward 6 for 6 months. No constituent services, no voice. And there's a lot of things coming up, like a football stadium. As you know, Charles Allen has led the city on saying that is not a good use of our funds, is a football stadium, you know, that you only use, what, 10 times a year when we have these other things. So we would lose that voice for some period of time, and that is not good government.
Mm. talk a little bit more about this, where this is coming from, because I mean, I hear that it's a mixture of sort of blaming Charles Allen for the safety issues based on a perception of what his record is on certain pieces of legislation, which probably the folks are widely misinformed about what the criminal code rewrite was all about. But without going into those details, is this a unique recall in the sense of this national level involvement? I'm hearing rumors of Republican and national level investment in this recall, and you sort of referred to this national trend. So is this really a different type of recall than we've seen before?
Well, the first thing is, any of the legislation that people are upset about was basically done when Charles ran for re-election 18 months ago.
Right.
And they did not run anybody against them. Mm-hmm. So this idea now, like, what's different today than before? Now, we've had a terrible spasm of crime in Washington, D.C., and we're all upset about it. To blame the legislator on this spasm of crime is to ignore the fact we had a pandemic of 2.5 years of no structure of people that are, you know, it's what. So the first thing is that it's a little illogical. Mm-hmm. It's very emotional. And it is, I'm upset about crime. My neighbor may have been carjacked, or a family member, or I may have been impacted by crime, and I'm upset about it. And I don't know if the city really is getting the attention to it that they need. And so the recall brings attention to that. But the national relationship, I mean, I went through the, you know, they only have to report twice, right at, you know, shortly after you establish the committee, and then the, you don't have to report who donated to you until July 31st. I've asked, and as chair, we're going to release who's all donating to Charles. We're going to ask the same of the other folks, so people can look at that and gauge that. But they don't have to report by law until July 31st. But we know in their first report that there's Republican groups, especially out of Virginia, and staffers, Republican staffers, that have been, you know, helping fund this. And that's not to discount that there's Ward 6 residents that are upset about crime, that have focused on the council member, that are also a part of this. I don't want to discount that at all.
Sure.
But they have opened the door for national Republicans to get involved. They've opened the door, and the national Republicans, they know that they're in trouble in cities across America. If Donald Trump is going to get reelected, they've got to suppress and do something about cities voting in mass for Democrats. And this is all, you know, it's part of discrediting cities. But also, you saw that in Virginia, their ads were on our TVs and our social media. Mm-hmm. The Republicans in Virginia ran entirely on crime. The, you know, on the other side, the Democrats went on women's health care and women's autonomy to make their own healthcare decisions. We won throughout Virginia, but that vein is still there, and they're, you know, they're sending money for recalling our council member.
Yeah, well, it's definitely going to be interesting to see how it plays out. I will say, just as an observer, that I'm, you know, always aware that we have folks who live in D.C. who came here to work for certain entities, you know, or maybe national level legislature, maybe for lobby firms, maybe for, you know, arms manufacturers, who knows? But they also live here, and I think generally are a little less involved in the local politics. And so for me, it's a little bit of a scare to see people who I think may, you know, and this is not to speak to the recall itself, but the underlying justification for the recall, that there's a lack of real connection to what I perceive as, like, you know, more rooted long-term residents who also have a concern about safety, but we're not talking about inequality and disparity and poverty and the you know, rising cost of living here in DC and how that has also impacted so many people. But
you're right, Parisa. And the other part of this is Charles is now chair of the committee over the environment. Mm-hmm. And as you know, he's helping lead this Healthy Homes initiative to switch over to electricity from fossil fuel gas. And I think there's at least one or two, there may be Democrats, but lobbyists for fossil fuels that have looking to help support the recall. I mean, this is a divisive time, and Charles is leading the way on the environment.
Right. I think he even, didn't he question the Project Pipes, the big Washington Gas project
Let me be sure that you're clear on that. This is AltaGas that uses the name Washington Gas.
Okay.
But AltaGas is a Canadian company. These utilities like Washington Gas, they're like construction companies. They make their money in return off large construction projects. And yes, they want us to be continuing to use gas so that they can build these, put these pipes in and redo the pipes, which will be a 100-year investment that the city, one way or the other, would be on the hook for. And so Charles came out against that. And that impacts this international company that if Charles is successful, they're not going to be able to make money off of us to keep using, you know, fossil fuel because we're switching over to electricity.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the environment because, you know, like you said, you served as the director of DC's Department of Energy and Environment for about 8 years. And, you know, I have to say that I agree that there's some really good people in DOEE. I've also been a little frustrated with lack of action in certain areas. And I'm constantly reflecting on how young our local government is. I think this agency is only, 20 years old?
The agency was established in 2006.
So less than 20 years old. And I say that mostly because I perceive it to be a government where we still have to do a lot of work to shape the agencies and to shape, you know, the structures and systems in place. But I wonder on DOEE's ability to really be a leader on environmental justice. And I want to discuss it with you because environmental justice is, of course, one of our key priorities at Empower DC, but it's also so intersectional, right? There's multiple agencies that touch the related issues of environmental justice. And a lot of it has to do with land use decisions. And, you know, certainly there's, you know, factors around on pollution permitting and emissions and things like that. But there's so many, many aspects to it. What is needed from your perspective, if you wouldn't mind kind of sharing your view after having led the agency, what would be needed to make it possible for DOEE to really further and advance environmental justice in DC?
So when I was at DOEE, and you know, as you know, that's very recently, we created a diversity and equity task force that's representative. DOEE deals things from like asbestos to the fisheries. Like we cover so much, and so it's jointly together to create a diversity and equity task force. And so almost all initiatives now and grants and such are to run through this equity filter of what DOEE does. And so part of the North Star for each disparate entity is to do that. Now, I believe that, you know, the other side is that it's regulatory, that they, you know, whether it be permits or just investigating violations, say an illegal discharge of some type of, well, any type of even water discharge into the Anacostia River, you have to have a permit for a discharge. They do that. And then something that you and I'll get into is air quality, that if there's either noxious or odors that reach a certain level, or if there are, say, paint fumes from, you know, we used to have these paint shops, especially out through Ward 5, that we get involved in, that if they don't have all the adequate filters, and even goes as far as cigar bars, that you have to have all these filters in order to operate a cigar bar. So DC gets involved, or DC Department of Energy and Environment goes anywhere from having a wildlife action plan for protecting wildlife in the city to dealing with companies and other things that have an impact on the environment. I do believe that there is probably one, I mean, there's a very, very strong overlay of equity and diversity at the agency and how they work. So I'm not sure. I know that now and then there's going to be outcomes that we don't like. But we follow the regulations and the laws that are passed. And then, you know, we generally, sometimes, you know, there's accusation of overreach, but, you know, that's possible too.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of the issue is sometimes the laws and the regulations were not developed with vulnerable communities in mind, right? So they're not strong enough. You know, I mean, one example of that right now is EPA lowering the particulate matter allowance. You know, so there's a standard for how much particulate matter in the air is considered okay, and EPA has now acknowledged that standard that we've been using all this time is too high, and they're lowering it. And that same kind of assessment, I think, needs to take place in many areas, because we didn't factor in, you know, the policies didn't factor in vulnerable communities, children, seniors, people with, you know, pre-existing conditions, and the cumulative impact of multiple facilities in an area. And so I want to talk about this facility in Ivy City, the National Engineering Products, which is a, in my opinion, a relic of environmental racism, that this company would have been allowed to locate in a residential Black community as early as the 1930s. It's been operating, we don't know exactly what year it entered Ivy City, but evidently sort of fell off the radar of the district government. Of course, it predated Home Rule, it predated the Clean Air Act, it predated a lot of things. But when we started talking about this more robustly a couple of years ago, you know, DOE admitted that they didn't know it was there. And so we've been in this process of trying to follow the laws and regulations and really try to get it shut down, because we believe it should not be there in this residential neighborhood. And as DOEE director, you took a look at this facility. And I wonder if you could share, you know, what actions you took or attempted to take, and what was the outcome, and sort of what is your perspective? How does this facility show us where we need to do better?
Yeah, this facility makes adhesives, as you know, for the Navy. And it's a private company that's been there, like you said, the 30s, to make adhesives for the Navy. And the adhesives that they use have an odor. So the first thing that we did is we sent our air quality people out to test the air to see if they found, you know, discharges that would violate, you know, the regulations. And they did not. So the next thing I did was, and this was from one of the environmental justice folks that works with EPA, suggested this, and I did this. So I sent our water quality people out to go into the storm drains. Say, you know what? Let's see if they ever poured any of this out into your storm drain, which is not an uncommon thing. And they went through there and sampled the storm drain and could not find any illegal substances. I think that the use of this building is incompatible with the neighborhood around it. As you know, it looks like it's almost a gerrymandered line for industrially zoning it right next to the houses. Mm-hmm. And so, because, as you pointed out, land use wise, it's legal what they're doing, to DOEE trying to see if there's anything that they're exceeding and find no exceedances, that they're not violating anything. But I think it's incompatible. And so, you know, from my time on the council, there were times when we took pieces of property and repurposed it. I think that needs to happen here, that I think that the city needs to acquire the property, and then it'd be a much better use to turn that into affordable housing, especially as Ivy City starts, you know, gentrifying, displacing. the things that happen as we all know in Ivy City that clearly it's becoming a much economically higher value area. But there's a number of areas, Parisa, where we were concerned, and one of them, you know, was very close to there, was where the train yards are, where the switchers. The switchers are the old diesel trains that they keep moving the engines. They keep them going, and they burn high sulfur, you know, they burn high sulfur diesel. And the air quality over there is impacted by the fact that we have switchers over there. And so when we got Volkswagen settlement money, we put an equity overlay on how that money should go out and put up grant money to Amtrak to say, use this funds to buy low sulfur or electric, if you're willing to do electric engines, instead of you're using 50 to 75 year old engines, or at least 50 year old engines. And so that area, Ward 5 has more industrially zoned area than anywhere else. That's where you'll find DDOT, where they park their trucks and a lot of their stuff over there. Exactly. And so when, and the problem is, and you know this around equity and environmental justice, where do they build affordable housing? They build it in the least desirable areas of a city. So they build it around industrial zones. And so you have a whole environmental justice and social equity issue from the moment that you build next to these areas. We're going to see this obviously with climate change, because affordable housing was built in flood zones, and that's going to be a problem. So this DOE is very aware of this, is part of the solution. But in this particular case, it appears that what this this entity is doing, making adhesives, is legal, and that they need to work possibly with the Navy or others to relocate it, get it out of an area that has so many residential homes.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for going on record stating that it should be, you know, shuttered and moved. And I think, again, for me, it's let's take care of this particular facility, but let's also understand the underlying forces that led to this. So some of it has to do with the grandfathering in of facilities that, you know, per our current laws would not be allowed to be this close in proximity to residential. Some of it is, you know, making sure that we have stronger standards around emissions, because, you know, the odor is emissions, right? And so we won't have time to go much more into that right now, but hopefully we'll have a part two of our conversation. And as we close out, I'd love to hear from you. What's next for Tommy Wells? Are you any mayoral runs on the horizon? Any more government roles? Or are you just going to focus on, you know, family and your other
interests? I have not ruled anything out, but I do know that I'm very proud of the work that I've been able to do. So I will be going on the board of directors for the Anacostia Riverkeeper. The Anacostia Riverkeeper does a great job of really accountability and bringing the public there to show, you know, what incredible resources is. But as you know, you can't have a better symbol for, you know, inequity. You know, we cleaned up the Potomac River for the most part, but there's the Anacostia River that going back to when the city dump was on the river. So I'll stay involved with the river cleanup through the Anacostia Riverkeeper. I'm looking to potentially have a role with DC Appleseed. They're good government. They're not political, but yet they're an honest broker on bringing about good government. And so I'm looking in the future having a role with DC Appleseed. And as you know, I just recently published a column with Greater Washington, and I'm looking to get a lot more involved with Greater Washington because of the role they have in helping see a future of the city that A, is equitable, especially around transportation and affordable housing. So I'm staying fully engaged, focused on DC, not nationally or internationally. And we will see what happens in the future. You know, the mayor's race is quite a bit off. You know, that's 3 years from now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we welcome you back when you have more to share on that. And for the listeners, if you want to follow what's happening with the No Ward 6 Recall, go to noward6recall.org or follow No Ward 6 Recall on Twitter. And Tommy Wells, again, thank you for taking time to be with us on Taking Action today.
And I'm on Twitter at Tommy Wells, you know, obviously Perfect. Early adopter, got my name. All right. Thank you. And thank you for the work you're doing and for being on WPFW. I listen to WPFW. And I think it's such, especially now when news organizations are leaving coverage from the district, what you're doing is so important. And WPFW plays such a great role. Encourage everyone that's listening, as we all need to, just be sure that we support our local public radio.
Thank you for saying that. Appreciate it. Well, enjoy your afternoon. Thank you again for being on. We're going to welcome in our second guest here in just a moment. We're going to take a quick music break. On Taking Action here on WPFW 89.3 FM. And I'm excited to welcome our second guest, the co-founder and executive director of Electrify DC, Vanessa Bertelli. Thank you, Vanessa.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yes, happy to have you on and hear about your organization and your upcoming Healthy Homes Fair, which is April 6th. And we'll share all those details. But if you could just first give us a little bit of introduction to yourself and how you came to found this organization.
Of course. And it is really wonderful to be on this show because Taking Action is exactly what drove this. So I am Vanessa Bertelli. I live in Ward 4. It was 2020 and I was trying to figure out how to, you know, I have three young children and I was getting increasingly worried and I was really trying to figure out what I could do. I, as a single person, could do to ensure they could live on a healthy planet. And all the solutions were too far from reach. And so after a lot of research, I figured out I wanted to research where we could make the most difference as individuals in climate change, and I realized that 25% of our emissions, of the total final emissions of the district, come from our homes, and this number just like opened up a window on, well, if 25% of emissions come from our homes, then surely there is something that we as homeowners or renters can do about that. And so, long story short, we co-founded Electrify EDC to make it easier, faster, and more affordable for everyone to decarbonize their homes.
Mm. So talk a little bit more about what decarbonize means for folks who are listening who may not be familiar with that term.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know intimately what decarbonization means because when I figured this out, when I understood how much our choices, our individual choices affected the environment, I decided to decarbonize my own home. And so we're talking about a 1928 home, typical of DC. I needed to essentially take out all of the appliances that were burning fossil fuels. By 2032 in DC, the grid will need to, the electricity that comes to our homes will need to come from renewables. This mm-hmm. is wonderful. It's great. But it means that anything that is not connected to an outlet, anything that is does not run on electricity will not run on renewables. And so in a home, that means replacing for most people that is our gas furnaces, mm-hmm. our gas water heaters, our gas dryers, and our gas stoves. In addition to removing from inside a home, which is what I was able to do in my home, in addition to this, we need to better insulate our homes so that we're not heating and cooling air that gets wasted to the outside. So in a nutshell, decarbonizing means making on your home as much energy as you produce, as you use. And so by adding solar to or participating in community solar, you're essentially making energy. And then by reducing the amount of energy that you use inside the home and making sure that none of it comes from fossil fuels, you remove the carbon from your home.
Mm-hmm. And the issue of gas appliances is something that we have talked about on the show before. Some of the studies that have come out that linked gas appliances to some health concerns. Do you want to speak a little bit more to why eliminating the gas appliances is important? You mentioned for climate change, but also for people's health.
Yes, that is very concerning news. Children living in a home with a gas stove have a 42% increased risk of experiencing asthma symptoms. Mm. That is incredible. And it is also, and this is just from the gas stoves, but a lot of the fossil fuels that are burnt inside our homes are burnt from other appliances as well. And so we end up with high concentrations of toxins that stay inside the home, especially if homes are not ventilated properly. And that just adds layers of unhealthiness to our homes. But not only inside our homes, Parisa, because what we combust, the toxins that we combust inside our homes make it to the outside and increase pollution in the outside. So in our environment. So it's both inside the home and outside the home.
Yes. And so you all have organized this Healthy Homes Fair, and I expect this is an opportunity for folks to come and learn more about how to decarbonize, right, your home and how your appliances are affecting you. Talk a little bit about more about this fair and who is this geared towards and what should folks expect when they come?
So when I was going through the process in my home, I realized that doing this was not as easy as it should have been. And that was in part because the information was not available in a way that was easily consumable, but also the home renovation professionals did not have a full understanding about how to decarbonize or what the options out there were, what the technologies available were, and how much more advanced than they thought these were. And so that's what made us realize at Electrify DC that there really is a need to essentially have a gigantic show and tell for adults, where people can just come, whether you're a homeowner, you're a renter, or you're a home renovation professional. You need to be able to see, touch, ask questions about these appliances and these products that really allow us to decarbonize. And it's not only the technologies, products, and services, but it's also the enormous amount of incentives that are available through the Inflation Reduction Act that is now trickling down to our states. And so people need to have better access to the information about these incentives. And we are super happy to be able to, we've developed an app for the Healthy Homes Fair that will allow people to navigate it. And I'm showing it to Parisa on the screen, but it's essentially, it allows you to not only have information on the exhibitors, which are over 70 exhibitors, will be at the fair. This is a mix of manufacturers, service providers, nonprofits that educate about the various aspects of decarbonization. Not only have access to the program, there will be a rolling program in sort of 15 minutes intervals about the different appliances, health aspects, and so on, but also to calculate. It's linked to the Rewiring America calculator that allows each and every one of us to just plug in five pieces of information: where we live, if we file jointly or single, and if and our postcode, and to be able to immediately calculate what the tax incentives and rebates are for each and every one of these appliances or things that we can do to our homes. Mm.
I have to say, this has really been a growing area of awareness. I feel like it's, at least here in DC, certainly, you know, first with the solar, access to solar, and then now more and more conversation about appliances and, you know, pending legislation at the council, the Healthy Homes Act to support residents to be able to make the swap, because, of course, there is an expense involved. But like you said, there's rebates and incentives. What is valuable to renters in this? Are, you know, renters who may not be making the decision about what appliances are in the home, can they still gain by coming to the Healthy Homes Fair?
Absolutely. And we've made it, we've been very intentional about designing the experience in a way that is helpful to homeowners. We have a number of exhibitors that, in fact, cater only to renters. Renters. And so one of our, we've designed a number of scavenger hunts for our public. So we have a scavenger hunt for renters, one for students, one for home renovation professionals, and so on. And the one for renters is exactly guiding renters through the exhibit to be able to go visit with the exhibitors that cater to their needs. So it's not only access to community solar, but it's real life hacks of how to make the most of what is in your home. So for example, we will have on display a hack of how to take an existing gas stove, remove certain components of it, disconnect from gas, and then put an induction burner plug-in on top of a sort of counter piece of counter in order to extend, increase your counter space and be able to cook with the power of magnets through your induction burner. And in fact, we have eight plug-in induction burners up for grabs amongst our fabulous prizes. So yes, there's real intentionality there. There's also very sort of quick and easy to implement things for homeowners and renters, like caulking workshops. So one of the easiest way to lose a ton of energy is through the crevices in our walls. And homeowners and renters alike can, with a good tube of caulk, remedy a lot of those. So we will be having caulking workshops and we'll be giving away caulk.
Oh, okay. I think I need some of that. So I'm intrigued. I'm also intrigued because I do have gas appliances and it is something that I'd like to move towards switching out. So I will be there on Friday, April 6th at the Healthy Homes Fair. And again, is that the correct date?
Yes, it's Saturday.
Saturday.
From 1 to 5. And that is when the fair is open to the general public. We have a training session for home renovation professionals from 10 to noon of that same morning. And there's one thing that I would like to highlight is that in order for us to be able to decarbonize all of these homes, whether they're homes that people rent or homes that people own, we're going to need to replace approximately 200,000 appliances in the next 6 years. That Wow. is a ton of appliances. And currently, we do not have the people to do that. So workforce is very much a necessity for our organization. And so the Healthy Homes Fair is intentional in reaching out to career seekers to be able to show them all of the jobs and careers that will be available, that are available, and that will be in much need with the very good salaries for the next 20 years that it will take us to decarbonize all of the district's 300,000 residential units.
So very interesting. Yeah, no, that's good that you're thinking about that green jobs pipeline. And so before we close out again, just to remind people, the fair is Saturday, April 6th. And as you stated, from 1 to 5 at the DC Armory, and you can go to healthyhomesfair.org to get all the information and register, which is probably not required, but it gives you an idea of who's coming, right? Can folks show up whether or not they've registered?
Yes, we will be at the door ensuring that everybody can download the app to make sure that they have the best experience from the fair. We should also point out that the fair is absolutely free to all to attend.
Wonderful.
Yes.
So come on out to the free Healthy Homes Fair, and just to tell us, Vanessa, briefly as we close out, what's next after the Healthy Homes Fair? What is your organization looking to do shorter?
So it's a lot of systemic and structural stuff. A lot of it relates to workforce development, working with all of the professions that surround the transaction and the renovation of homes, but also working on our demonstration sites. We intend to have a demonstration site in each one of the 131 neighborhoods of the district. And wow. So if anybody out there is interested, is a homeowner or renter willing to be one of these demonstration sites, we would happily sort of handhold and connect with all the different programs and incentives and sort of help you reach out to the rest of your neighborhood to be that example and to make the whole decarbonization process more familiar to your friends and neighbors.
It sounds very intriguing. So again, everybody who's interested in learning more about how to decarbonize their home, touching and feeling the actual appliances. I hear you have like a petting zoo of appliances.
We will be having a lot of cooking demonstrations on induction. So there will also be some tasty treats.
Snacks.
We have a bouncy castle mandatory and solar powered ice cream trucks. So we are also joining forces with an electric bike tasting party. So you'll also be able to ride, test ride all configurations of electric bikes and scooters. So it should be a lot of fun.
Sounds good. And yes, so my daughter can jump in the bouncy house while I look at some appliances. That might be the incentive I needed to drag her out of the house on Saturday. So
precisely.
Well, thank you again. It's great to meet you, learn about this event, and look forward to having you on in the future as we talk more about the workforce aspects, et cetera. But listeners, again, healthyhomesfair.org, Saturday, April 6th at the DC Armory. Check it out. And Vanessa, we'll stay in touch and wishing you much success.
Thank you, Parisa. Thank you for having us. Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks to the listeners of Taking Action Today and everybody in the studio at WPFW. Stay tuned for the next program on deck. I believe it's COVID, Race, and Democracy, but first, the news.
From WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. A massive search effort is underway for six construction workers who were on the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore when it was struck by a large cargo vessel and collapsed. Baltimore City Fire Chief James Wallace told reporters this morning that the scene was in active search and rescue. He said at least two people have been rescued from the water. One wasn't hurt and one was in very serious condition. Authorities have not stated an official cause for the crash, but Maryland Governor Wes Moore said in a news conference that the crew on the ship were able to issue a mayday before colliding into the bridge, which allowed the authorities to stop incoming traffic from going onto the bridge. He said the crash seems to be an accident and added that the bridge was up to code. The four-lane, 1.6-mile-long bridge opened in 1977. The Maryland Transportation Authority is searching for alternative transport options for the roughly 35,000 people using the bridge every day, noting that they will be directing people to instead use two major tunnels, the Harbor Tunnel and the Fort McHenry Tunnel. In other news, the U.S. Supreme Court began hearing oral arguments today in a case over access to mifepristone, a pharmaceutical used in both medication abortion and miscarriage care. The High Court, which has a conservative supermajority, will then decide whether to maintain full access to the drug or reverse regulation changes that made medication abortion more accessible in recent years. This includes allowing the pills to be prescribed via telemedicine, delivered in the mail, and used up to 10 weeks of pregnancy instead of 7. A final decision from the Supreme Court on mifepristone could come as early as May or June. Medication abortion was used in 63% of abortions in the United States during 2023, according to a report released earlier this month by the Guttmacher Institute. In more legal news, an appeals court yesterday ruled former President Donald Trump can have 10 additional days to pay a reduced $175 million bond to appeal the $454 million civil fraud judgment against him, his adult sons, and his company. The ruling for now staves off the prospect of the New York Attorney General seeking to seize his property to enforce the judgment. Trump was ordered to pay the penalty after a New York City judge in February found that Trump repeatedly lied about the value of his assets over several years, to secure loans and make deals. His sons and former Trump Organization CFO Alan Weisselberg were also ordered to pay about $10 million in financial penalties. Meanwhile, in the separate hush money criminal case, a judge ruled the trial against Trump will begin on April 15th with jury selection. The case, which was slated to begin yesterday, was earlier delayed after defense attorneys raised issues with the late production of over 100,000 pages of potential evidence by federal prosecutors. During a hearing yesterday, Judge Juan Merchan rejected Trump's request for an additional delay or to dismiss the case altogether. Trump is accused of falsifying business records to cover up a 100 and